Hey guys, I hope you're loving the Making Bank episodes. Please make sure you guys like and share these episodes, as well as comment below for the guests. They love to come back and interact with you. And I really appreciate you watching and listening to Making Bank, so thank you.
You are listening to Making Bank, where we uncover the mindset and success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business.
Welcome to Making Bank. I am Josh Felber, where we uncover the mindset and the success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business today. I am excited for today's guest, Mitch Miller, Garrett Gunderson,
Babak Azad,
Marshall Silver, Dennis Hughes,
Syed Bulky, Kevin Harrington, hey, to Making Bank.
Josh, good to see you, man.
Yeah.
How's it going?
It's awesome to actually have you on now, for
fantastic.
Sure, man.
It's great to be here.
So for that 1% out there that doesn't know who you are or what you do, can you give us a quick overview?
Sure, yeah. So I started 1984. I was watching TV, and all of a sudden the screens went dark and found out that the channel was Discovery, and it was only an 18-hour-a-day network. So I said, I'll fill the other 6 hours with products. So I started putting products on back in the early 80s, kitchen products, then fitness products. So Tony Little Fitness and Jack LaLanne and the Juicer, and then George Foreman and all these kind of, you know, we did the Jenners, and I did Bruce and Kris Jenner when he was Bruce before Caitlyn,
right?
And then we did the Hilton family with Kathy Hilton and then Paris Hilton, and you name it, I've done, you know, this as seen on TV infomercial kind of business.
So sure.
Hundreds of products, $5 billion in sales, give or take. So I'm kind of like a creator of this infomercial space.
Sure.
And now what's happening is there's a little bit of disruption going on there. And actually, you mentioned Shark Tank, so I got a call from Mark Burnett along the way, and I did actually 175 segments on Shark Tank.
Wow, and you were one of the first ones, right?
Yeah, I was in the first go around. There's five segments to a show, so 35 one-hour shows I shot in the beginning of Shark Tank. So
right.
And now they all run reruns on CNBC, plus they run all around the world.
Yeah.
It's running in dozens of countries. So it's been a kind of a good run from being in the infomercial space and Shark Tank, and now I have a chance to see what's going on in the market. And TV viewership is dropping, and so I said there's disruption.
Sure.
And where are they going? Well, they're going to social media, they're going to Facebook. People spend hours a day on Facebook instead of sitting in front of their TV set.
Right.
So I'm having to follow the eyeballs, and as you know, this is the future, digital.
For sure.
So that's what we're doing.
Awesome. And so, I mean, and you've got to see the whole spectrum, you know, being on TV, as well as now with the whole digital marketing and everything else. As you were growing in TV and everything else, what were some of your biggest challenges encountered along the way?
So, I mean, look, when we first started putting products up, we'd have big success, and now it's like, okay, well, success equals financial distress because you need inventory.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, I was selling, you know, Ginsu knives at one point. I'm selling Chinese woks, and I'm selling Tony Little Fitness products, and I need 200,000 of them, okay, of each one.
Sure.
So how do I get 1 million pieces of inventory that cost $10 a piece?
Right.
That's $10 million, right? Well, I had to get very creative in raising capital and going to banks and going to venture capitalists, and, you know, because when I started, I didn't have any money,
right?
So, you know, now, every one I could get, I would make a profit, so we actually started just bootstrapping out of profits. You know, we'd sell a few, take the profits, go back, buy more inventory. But eventually, one of the biggest things, I think, the breakthrough for me was learning how to raise capital.
Okay.
And talk to investors.
Sure.
So nowadays, my business model is a little different. You know, I'm still a product guy, but I'm now more of a business guy. Like, I invest in businesses and get equity, and some of these are public companies. So I take capital to put into companies, but I will then help them go raise money. Because at the end of the day, without capital, it's very tough to build any business.
For sure.
You know? And you have to, you know, there's an art to raising capital. And I one of the things I talk about is creating the perfect pitch. So there's a pitch to get on Shark Tank and, you know, get somebody to say yes to being your partner. But, you know, that's also kind of involving getting a partner, raising capital. It's the pitch to get investors. And that's a little different than a pitch to sell the product, obviously.
Right,
right?
For sure.
So I kind of, that first challenge was money related. Okay. And then the next part of it was getting the right team. Because in the 80s, there was not a sophisticated world of marketers, digital. I mean, today you got
nobody knew what digital marketing was.
So many different, you know, back then it was like, who's going to process my credit cards? Well, my local bank was my processor.
Yeah.
They had no idea what they were doing, even,
right.
You know? So today things are a lot more sophisticated. You got somebody that does everything, and it's in this digital world is just, it's amazing.
I guess give us a little bit of background. I mean, how did you get started on the whole path to copy and kind of in this whole entrepreneur venture that you're down this today?
It was kind of an accident. I mean, I almost died when I was 21. So if that didn't happen, then none of this business shit would have happened. So what happened was I was in rock bands all my teenage years. And because of that, I enjoyed the guitar more than school. So I never went to school, never went to high school, any of that. And so I never graduated high school. It was all partying, you know, drugs, rock and roll, women, multiple women, you know, multiple parties, drugs, all that stuff. Anyway, when I was 21, I had a heart attack from doing those things in excess. And it was pretty crazy. And at the time, the band was pretty successful. I mean, we were offered a record deal by Chad Kroeger, who was the singer of Nickelback, which was the largest band in the world at the time. We were on the radio already touring and stuff like that. But our singer ended up having a mental breakdown and he left the band and he was the chief songwriter. And so that plus the heart attack, it was just kind of like everything was over. And I was like, man, this. And so I was 21 when I had the heart attack. So that I was okay. Like, the heart like 100% recovered and I was out of the hospital in a couple of days. You know, young people are resilient. So it was pretty crazy. So that was like the wake up call and it actually woke me up. And what's cool is like you talk about the 1%, like the entrepreneur is a person who's like the way I almost describe it is like that person's awake. You know what I mean? So that woke me up. And before that, I wasn't even remotely awake. I was having fun, but I was, you know, the furthest thing from wanting to improve myself or anything like that. So that's when I decided I wanted to do something different. And I was awake. So I was looking for something, you know, when the student's ready, the teacher appears. So I found Tony Robbins somehow and Robert Kiyosaki and those guys were talking about like, you don't have to be the same person you are. You know, Robert Kiyosaki said, you don't want $1 million. You want to, that's not the right question. It's not how I can make $1 million. It's how can I become the type of person that's worth $1 million or worth having $1 million hit him? And I was like, oh shit. And Tony Robbins, like, you don't have to be the same person you've been. It's like, I don't care what your background is. You can be whatever you want. So I was like, whoa.
Mind blown.
mine was blown. I was like, holy shit. I don't have to be me. I can like be a better version of me. And so to make a long story short, Tony Robbins interviewed Jay Abraham on one of his interview sessions and it changed everything. I was like, marketing, business, this is so exciting. And marketing has been my passion ever since then, since 2005 or four, or whatever that was. And so I went down the path of changing myself, trying to build businesses, failed 9 times, trying to build all sorts of businesses from landscaping companies to building pallets to online companies and all this and failing and trying and, you know, walking into businesses cold, trying to sell them stuff and basically trying everything under the sun and not having it work. Not because what I was saying or what I was doing wasn't right. It was because I was still me. You know, people look at me, they just didn't want to do business with me still because I was still me. And so, yeah, over the last 10, 12 years, I've really just, my passion has been learning about like and really studying as a student obsessively marketing and advertising, and that paired with the entrepreneurialism, I think has helped me succeed. And now in a way where I understand this stuff at such a crazy deep level because of my obsession for studying it for so long.
No, that's awesome. I mean, that you became, you know, that obsession, you know, has now turned, you know, that became that passion and what, you know, where you're heart and where your mind and everything is now. I do remember a cool story you had told me a little bit about was when you had your landscaping business and you were trying to figure out, hey, how can I generate revenue? And you talked about writing this letter to help other landscapers, I think it was. Do you remember?
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden you had like this little seminar business helping landscapers.
Yeah, and that was totally, that was about a year after the landscape, because winter came along and I didn't want to, in Canada, you don't do landscaping in the winter, you have to like shovel sidewalks. I didn't want to do that. So I'm like, oh, maybe I'll create a seminar for other landscapers so that they can hit the ground running next season.
Yep. Well, and that's the cool thing though, was, you know, as you were moving down that path, you know, and finding out who you were and, you know, discovering kind of your passion and your focus, you started to move yourself in that direction. So whether it was, you know, creating that marketing and creating those sales, you know, pieces to help other landscapers, you know, which now today you're out helping other people grow their business. You're helping other people, you know, move their businesses forward through coaching and consulting, which was back kind of that prelude that you did, you know, years ago that led you down that path now. So that's pretty awesome.
Whoa, you just gave me some introspection into myself that I didn't even know I had. Some reverse going on. But I think what it really is, man, is that I actually really enjoy teaching, and I think if you're gonna fucking teach people, you got to teach them the right thing. So like, you know, there's a guy who's teaching just so he can make a buck and sell his courses and just make some money online and shit. And it's not that there's anything wrong with that if what he's selling is good. But I truly see myself, especially when I get older, because right now I still see myself as young and reckless and whatever. As like, I want to be one of those philosophers who really change the game and who really, you know, take the body of knowledge that we have today and just really take that torch and just move it on and just do something more meaningful than just selling a few info products or something.
Give me a little bit of background kind of on who you are and how you got started down this path.
Well, I grew up in this small coal mining town. I mean, it's so small that I took some friends there because we were out at this concert in Colorado and we were driving back through Utah. And I'm like, oh, where I live is just 8 miles down that road where I grew up. And they're like, whatever. I'm like, you guys want to see it? So I'm driving them through. They're like, dude, you didn't live here. And out walks this girl, Amanda McFarland. And I'm like, Amanda. She's like, Garrett. I'm like, see, that was my neighbor. And they're like, no way, man. So, but yeah, I mean, my dad was a coal miner, my grandfather's, my great grandfather's. But, you know, when I was a kid, I used to just kind of mow lawns. That was kind of my basic mode of making money until I was 15. And my dad, being a coal miner, brought home these surface vehicles. When the bosses would come in town, clean them up, I started helping him. My mom worked at a credit union. They'd repossess vehicles. I went to the president, started detailing those cars, and I launched the most brilliantly named company, Garrett Gunderson's Car Care. It took me a long time to think of that one. But 15 years old, I launched that. I won third place for the Rural Young Entrepreneur of the Year that year. The next year, I won first place, and then I won the SBA Young Entrepreneur of the Year when I was 17 years old for 30 and under. I didn't win it again, and until 30 and under, but I won it when I was 17 at least.
So tell me a little bit about what kind of makes you different compared to what is out there. Because now you see, like, you know, Tony's promoting, you know, with his Money Mastery book and kind of investing in the different indexes. But then I know another good friend of mine who does kind of a similar thing to you has already been, he'd been investing his clients' money that way for a long time. So it wasn't anything new. So I guess what kind of makes what you're doing different and how you've gotten the results for your people?
So we became experts in helping people keep more of what they make. Entrepreneurs have this kind of dilemma where I call it the treadmill dilemma. They think if they run harder and faster, they're going to get further ahead. So they think that revenue is always the answer. And in the world of finance, I was like, well, what about the biggest bills they have? Like, the biggest bill they probably have is their tax bill. And super highly affluent people, they have really good family offices that have accountants and attorneys that help them save tax. So I knew that if I could help someone save tax, that was a guaranteed return. If I could help them find inefficiencies where they are overpaying on hidden fees and commissions, that was a guaranteed return. Or if I could help them get better interest rates and better structures to their loans, that was guaranteed cash flow in their life. Or if there were duplicate coverages or costs with insurance, that could be money back in their life. And so I abandoned the commission and fee-based model, and I created what I called a tuition-based backed by results model, where we said, you write us a check so you know exactly what you pay us, and we're going to go and help, like, financial detectives and human ATMs put money back into your life now rather than tell you just to save more. But one of the biggest distinctions is we believe in cash flow investing instead of accumulation. I don't believe in waiting for 30 years hoping that it all works out. I think cash flow is king, and we want cash flow to come in through entrepreneurial income and investment income to cover someone's expenses. And as soon as they do that, they have economic independence, and that is our brand. We want economic independence for people. And that entrepreneurial income doesn't count if someone has to show up to earn the income the next day. They have to still monitor it and manage it and be responsible for it, but it has to come in whether they show up to the office the next day. And investment income is cash flow on a regular basis, so we help people, first of all, boost their profits and keep more of what they make. Second, get really strategic about how they can engineer wealth and find it through efficiency and coordination. Then third, turning on cash flow with their investments. But fourth, here's a big distinction between me and Tony. I believe to become wealthy, you have to be an entrepreneur for 91% of the population. Why? John Bowen put a book out there that said 91% of people worth $5 million or more had one thing in common. They were entrepreneurs. Tony says in his book, it's risky to be an entrepreneur, but it's riskier not to be in today's world, in my mind, because things are moving so quick and we're figuring out more efficient ways to replace human beings on some of the labor that in the past required human beings.
So one of the things that you were talking about was with when you're scaling and building it and knowing lifetime value and knowing the order CPA, one of the big things was merchant accounts. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't factor that merchant account into the total or average.
Right.
And that could be the difference of breaking even or losing money with it for sure.
Yep.
And I know I did some consulting a little while back, and I remember working with businesses and looking at that. And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, we got it all. And then when you come down and you start actually analyzing the numbers and everything, I'm not really a numbers guy, but we had a model or a spreadsheet, you know, Excel and stuff, that would look at that, and you start punching that stuff in, it makes a significant difference.
Yeah, totally.
And so.
Yeah, I mean, and I think a couple thoughts on that. So one is, I think every business needs sales, but I think particularly sure. when you're, the business is newer and younger, you know, you got to be, you got to be driving some sales, right?
Right.
So you got to know your model and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, you can have an operationally tight business, but if you got no sales, that whole thing is moot, right? Yeah. So, and that's frankly why, in some ways, once you're at 10 to 20 million, then really some of the real more, I wouldn't say advanced, but you spend more time on optimization.
Okay.
Now, you can't have a horrible model and get to 10 or 20 million, but at the same time, like, the emphasis on sales has got to be the key, right?
Sure.
And so if you're not selling, if you don't have an offer, I basically tell people, like, two offers, two channels. I think that's what you need to build a business.
Okay.
And you look at Beachbody, that's what we did. But, you know, it's basically Google and Facebook. Those are monster platforms. Most people are on those.
Right.
You know, do that. And so, you know, and then, so now tying this back to merchant processing, you know, that range, I know people were, they're paying like 2% plus, and then I know people paying double digits.
Sure.
Monster range, right? And typically it's the risk profile and all those kinds of things. But that is a monster range, but that can dramatically affect your business. Plus, it's not just merchant processing, it's chargebacks, refunds, all those little fees.
Yeah.
And honestly, merchant processing is the bane of most people's existence, right? Because how do you get approved? Like, you got Stripe and PayPal and all those other things, but still, it's like people don't know how to get a clear answer, and every platform has their own things, and you get approved to certain points, and you know, all that stuff. I mean, if you have a relatively clean business, you should have less issues, fewer issues.
Sure.
But still, trying to get a straight answer about merchant processing is a big, big deal. And so, you got to have that part optimized, but also say, like, you got to have sales, right? And if you don't have sales, the rest of it doesn't matter. So that's how I think about, I don't know why I thought about that, but I just think that the importance of understanding what's driving the business, but also if your cost structure is totally out of whack, you're going to be hampering yourself big time, right?
For sure. One of the things then is with the scaling part you were talking about, what do you think the three biggest challenges for you when you were at Beachbody, I guess, that you ran into as you were starting to scale and go from that $100 million to $1 billion?
You know, I think, look, I think a lot of the issues that bigger companies face, smaller companies face,
sure. right?
And I think it's proportionate. Right. So the reality is every company, frankly, probably hates IT. They work too slow. Their communication challenges. They're trying to figure out how to scale. I think those are commonalities. It's just how many people, proportionality,
smaller
distance.
Level,
right. Right. And so, and trust me, like, we had our challenges across all of those, and I think every business does. That's not rocket science, but I think in some ways, hopefully, it's also a little bit encouraging to know that, like, conceptually, the issue as a company is facing, a bigger one does too. And so, to that point, you know, working offers, right? At the end of the day, if you don't have a working creative and a working offer,
sure,
that's what you need. And so, you know, when we had shows that were working and creative that's working, it makes things a lot easier. And then the challenge is, how do you maximize the heck out of it, right? Which is what my team was responsible for.
Okay.
So I didn't do product development or creation of the shows. And so the analogy, let's say in the Facebook world, is what's your Facebook video ad? What's your offer? things like that. And then, but it was optimized from that point on. And so we were very, very obsessively focused on operational excellence. Okay. So once we had something that was working, how do we maximize the heck out of it? Like all the points in the conversion path, upsells, customer lifetime value, cost optimization. So we were constantly working that.
Right.
But at the core of it, if you don't have offers and campaigns and a channel that works, like that's the key, right? And that's right. When you talk about the challenges of scale, those were the bigger ones. Because, and then if you are making sure your target CPA and your, let's say, we called it an allowable,
okay.
Your target basically what you can afford to get a customer for,
right.
The higher that is, and it's the whole thing, whoever can afford to pay the most generally can own the media better.
Sure.
And we were just better at that than everyone else.
Yeah, right, yeah.
We became better, side. We had to.
Yeah.
But not just on the managing media side, but if, again, your target CPA is 30% above, like you have a target CPA of $15 and all your competitors are at $8, you're probably going to win.
Right.
Because you can afford more media and different types of media. And so that was the other part, which is like constantly trying to figure out how do we increase our allowable. And that's a lot of what I spent time with my clients on is figure out where does that optimization happen, right? And so whether you're six-figure business or 10-figure business, you've got to be focusing on that at least to a good extent, because if you drive sales and your target CPA is pretty high, that's a great combination.
Right.
Right? And so that's where it's a great place to spend time.
So I got introduced to you, like I said, it was about a year ago, and I got to see some of the subconscious reprogramming and one of my good friends happened to be up on the stage with you and everything.
And so you were at the ClickFunnels event.
Correct, yes.
Yeah.
So I got to see Leon.
Yep.
And so maybe give us a little bit of background so our audience knows, hey, you know, here's what Marshall does, and you know, and it's not just magic tricks and things like that. So
yeah, it's real magic. That's what it is. You know, the world knows me primarily as a hypnotist, and my media calls me the greatest hypnotist of all time. And I won't argue because I wrote that. And the thing that I know is that ultimately everything is hypnosis. You know, what we believe to be true is true for us, and we get to choose that belief. And so sometimes people believe that they're struggling to become rich. And when I was in my early 20s, I chose to believe that I was a multimillionaire whose money had not yet been deposited in my bank account. And because of that flip, that paradigm shift, everything changed for me. So rather than seeing everything as a struggle, I envisioned myself going through a forest, an evil forest with dragons and demons and all these things that I had to battle. And as I went through the forest, rather than getting more downtrodden and getting more beat up and saying, you know what, maybe it's never going to happen for me, because I was certain that my success was on the other side of this forest, every single dragon that I slayed, every single demon that I downed made me more inspired, and it made me realize you're one step closer. And so never feel bad about the stuff you're going through now. Guaranteed, it is certain your success is on the other side of this evil forest. The castle is there. The beautiful princess awaits you, or prince. And right. And then when you have that belief, when it's not thinking that maybe it'll happen, when there's a certainty in your mind that it's guaranteed to happen, you just need to keep going, then you will. And on the other side of that, you know, some people will say, yeah, but it's not guaranteed. Well, either way, you have to ask yourself the question, what would be the highest and best use of my time? What would be the best thing for me to believe? And certainly it wouldn't behoove anybody to believe that they weren't going to succeed. It wouldn't benefit you to think that this is going to fail. You might as well believe that it's going to succeed. Whether it succeeds or not, you will play your best game. And so, right. You know, that's one of the things that I tell people, deal with what emerges. Finding your life less than perfect is a waste of time, because it is what it is, and you have to deal with it.
No, I totally agree, and I know.
Tell I'm halfway through a cup of coffee.
One of the things is, you know, you talk about, you know, deal with what emerges and the complaining and everything else too. And that's one of the things too, is as my kids keep growing older and everything else. And so it's like, you know, talking
awesome. I have six, a four and a 2-year-old.
Oh, nice. Oh, you even got
all born at home in the bathtub, by the way, via hypnosis.
Wow.
No drugs, no pain, no doctors.
That's
we streamed.
Amazing.
My daughter's name is Prosperity, and we streamed her birth live online, had over 8,000 people watching. And it looks like my wife is sleeping through the birth. And there were people that were on the live chat that were saying, oh, this couldn't be real. She's not actually giving birth. Nobody looks like that giving birth. And so when I caught my daughter in my hands in the bathtub, because I caught all three kids and cut their umbilical cords, made their belly buttons. When I caught her in my hands on the live chat, this idiot says, see, that's not even a real baby. But that just goes to show that, you know, everybody's experience is based on validation.
Right.
So validation creates reality. So if everybody believes that births are supposed to be, you know, painful, or that making money, making bank is supposed to be difficult, then that's what they make it.
Yeah.
And so everybody watching this broadcast to believe that they are people and money magnets. In fact, you can even say it. I am a people and money magnet. And look around, because we find what we're looking for, what we focus on expands.
And so I guess, how did you get started? You know, what took you down the path, like, hey, I want to get into subconscious reprogramming, hypnosis? You know, what got you there?
Well, I was a magician as a kid. I started off on stage at 7 years old as a magician. At 10 years old, I discovered that I could make money doing what I did. That changed my world. You know, this poor farm boy, all of a sudden going, holy crap, I just do what I do already and I make money. This is a good deal.
Right.
And then as my life progressed, at 16 years old, at my high school, I got hypnotized. And the hypnotist gave me a suggestion that when he said the words "sunny boy," I would stand up from my seat in the audience. I'd walk back to the stage. I'd fall on my butt. I'd roll my pant legs up above my knees. I'd climb on his lap. I'd put my thumb in my mouth and say, "Sing it again, Daddy." And I was socially insecure as a kid. I mean, we were dirt poor. I wore my sister's clothes to school. And so when I went back to my seat in the audience, I said, there's no way in the world I'm going to do this. It's never going to happen. So I go back to my seat. He says, "Sunny boy." And I feel like a magnet's pulling me back to the stage. And I walk back to the stage and I fall on my butt and I roll up my pant legs and I climb on his lap and I say, "Sing it again, Daddy." And my mind is blown. It's one of those turning point moments. My mind blown. And I go home that night and I thought, gosh, what the heck just happened to me?
Right.
Was I hypnotized? Or was I just doing what he told me to do? And then I thought about it, Josh. I thought, well, what if he told you to get off drugs? Because at the time I was a drug addict. I was a cocaine and marijuana addict. I thought, what if he told you to get off drugs and you just did it? What if he told you to be confident and you just did it? What if he told you to go out and be a multimillionaire? And because he said that I could and I believed that I would, I just went out and took those actions and became a millionaire, I realized that that was hypnosis. And if this was hypnosis, it was the most powerful force on the planet.
Wow.
So those 1,500 words per minute that are going through everybody's brain, telling them who they are and who they aren't, what they can be, what they can do, what they can have, we control those thoughts. We choose those thoughts.
Sure.
And it's time for all of us to choose better thoughts.
Maybe let's just start off a little bit about what, you know, your background and how you kind of got started in all this.
So, Josh, I'm a runner like you. And I ran cross country. I ran Division I cross country too. I've run 20 something marathons, and I've learned that if you can outsuffer the other guy, like if you're running a 5K in high school and it's the last 100 meters and it's you and that other guy, or it's like me and the other guy, I'm going to win, right? I don't care how much you talk. I don't care how much you've trained. I don't care what school you're from, because when it's down to you and me in the last 100 meters, whoever can outmuscle it is the one that's going to win. And that's what I love about entrepreneurship. I learned that in high school and in college. I didn't speak English until I was six. And I was made fun of. I was put in the special needs classes. And my teacher, her name was Mrs. Gore, she would come up. She'd hold my cheeks and say, "Oh, you're so cute and so weird," you know. Yeah. And have you ever been in a situation like that, right, where you were mocked and then there was nothing you could do about it? And then other people who mean well, if you don't speak English, what do? They talk louder at you. Somehow, like if you don't know the words, if they talk louder at you, and if they somehow talk slow, like that's, I don't know what those words mean. Okay. So like, I'm not dumb. Right. And maybe it's because I had a chip on my shoulder or whatever, but through cross country, I learned that even if I couldn't speak very well, if I could beat you and win, it didn't matter what the ref had to say. It doesn't matter who's popular. And that, this is going to sound weird, but I'm an Asian, so I'm good at math. I would dominate in math and like standardized tests and things like that. And I would dominate in cross country, because both of those to me felt like they were math, right? Those were things that were governed by a specific set of rules. And you could use those rules
like how your body processes energy, you know, glycogen reserves, ADP, ATP, or just like, you know, there's many different ways to solve a math problem, but you still have to get to that right answer. There's mechanics behind business. So one of the things that I would do when I was in high school was I would sell candies. Do you remember Now and Laters?
Oh yeah.
So like these little, not like these, this is a Burt's Bees, but I would, this will show you like how I think. The school snack shack only sold, I think, Snickers and Milky Way. And they were something like 25 cents, which shows you like, you know, back in the day, things were cheaper. And I would go to the supermarket and find things that were on sale. And I would get like 15 or 20 different kinds of candies, put in my backpack and sell them like four for a dollar, five for a dollar. I'd sell them cheaper and I had greater variety. So the students, instead of going to the snack shack, they'd buy for me because I was cheaper and I had more variety. Further, they had these coupons. So if you were a parent and you gave your kid lunch money, that kid might go and just spend it on candy. But if they got this lunch coupon, they could turn that in for only a meal. So what I'd say is, if you give me your lunch coupon, I'll give you three candies, right? So I started to do arbitrage before I realized that. And some of these kids, I would let them have credit with me, like a line of credit, like up to maybe even like $5, right? Because I knew they got their allowance every week. And I carried that into boarding school. And I had a robust business where I took my mountain bike and I went to Choate Rosemary Hall in Wallingford, Connecticut, a rich boarding school. And I rode down to the bottom of the hill at the Stop and Shop and I would load up. I had a red wagon, right? A radio flyer wagon that I rigged up to hook up to the back of my seat. And I would buy like $100, $150 of groceries or sodas or things like that. And I would bike back up the hill and I would sell that stuff out of my dorm room. And that's what taught me e-commerce and entrepreneurship, because these rich kids would get their allowance every month, right? These were kids of billionaires or, you know, princes, like really, really rich kids went to this school. Like Ben Walton, who was the grandson of Sam Walton. I got to hang out with all these kinds of kids. And it taught me entrepreneurship at a really close level, because not only was I hanging out with these kids, but I would go to their houses, right? We would fly to some exotic place over the weekend and, you know, daddy's a billionaire. So we'd be able to, I learned so much about business that way. And that taught me mentorship. So imagine like my buddy, Bill Harnish, he's a multi-billionaire, largest divorce settlement in the history of New York. He's the guy who funded Costco and put the money in the Best Buy, multi-billionaire, hedge fund owner, right? And he's teaching me how he buys and sells companies. He's teaching me. I remember one time we were in, I want to say it was Park City, and we were in we stopped at the Costco because we were going to one of the resorts that he owned. And we stopped at a Costco to buy those giant muffin things. Have you seen those? It was like six giant muffins from Costco.
Right.
That's just like, it's like things you buy from Costco. And we were coming back to the rental car and I noticed there was a Nike outlet store right next to that. And I said, oh man, I'd love to get some new running shoes. And he said, yeah, go ahead. I'm like, oh, no, I don't want to make you wait because it'd only be like saving 10 bucks, but, you know, because I saw the outlet store was there. But I made that guy wait in the car for 35 minutes, right, while I was there trying to save $10, right, to get a pair of running shoes. So, but I learned so much. And if it wasn't for those kinds of opportunities, like I was mentored by Al Casey, who was the CEO of American Airlines when I went to SMU, right, for undergrad. And I learned about how an airline worked. And I got a job at American Airlines helping build the website and doing all the technology deals. I couldn't even get an interview at that company. I wanted to work at Nike. I submitted all my stuff. I had all my times. I had my good grades. I had all that kind of stuff. I couldn't even get an interview at that company. But to be able to then, almost 20 years later, get Nike as a client for Facebook ads and Facebook analytics, right? They've since brought that in-house. That just shows you that if it wasn't for those kinds of connections, like the big lesson for me, Josh, was it was the connections of the mentorship that meant everything. And I had previously thought it was all about how hard could I work? How hard could I run? What do I need to do? Because as a good Chinese student, I'm going to outstudy you. And thus asking other people for help is awkward. It's cheating. And I've learned in the world of business, cheating is the way to work. You know, mentorship, connections, other people who know things that you don't know, and you know things they don't know, and you collaborate, it's really that easy. I see most entrepreneurs are struggling where they're by themselves as some kind of like hero. Like they think they're LeBron James and they're going to carry the Cavaliers. And you're just going to lose.
Are you digging in there?
You're going to have 50 51 points and a triple double.
I know.
Sorry.
Give us a little bit of background. I always like to kind of start initially, especially first time interviewing with you, is, you know, how did you get started as an entrepreneur? You know, what kind of took you down that path?
Yeah. So, you know, entrepreneurship, man, I've been doing that since I was very, very young, but really in the tech space since I was 12. My parents moved from Pakistan to America.
Sure.
And I didn't speak English, actually. Okay. And I wanted a way to make some extra money because my dad was working 16 hours a day at a gas station, like swiping.
Sure.
You know? So I just wanted to figure out some ways so I can buy like chocolate, Mountain Dew, right? Like a 12-year-old.
Stuff that kids want.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I got into domaining.
Wow. Okay.
My cousin said, "Dude, you can like buy and sell domain names."
Yeah.
And I said, "Okay." And that's how I got into it. And you know, fast forward, agency, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow.
Affiliate marketing, blogging, and then software.
And then software.
Then software.
So he's like, domain names. And so, what did the domain process? What did that turn into then? A full.
So you know, I had no money.
Right.
You need some money to buy domain. So when I started, I was 12. I was basically fake posting for other people who had forums.
Okay.
They would just go hire people. They would post on listings, and I'd say, okay, yeah. So I was basically talking to myself in different forums to make it look like the forum had a lot of engagement, right? And these guys would pay me, but I really couldn't receive any money because I was like 12.
Right.
So I said, you have to pay me in domain credits. And that's how I started buying domains.
Nice.
And essentially, I was networking people like, oh yeah, you know, if you register me this domain, I'll give you two of my other domains. So I would like take, if you wanted a domain, I would just swap it out and take two.
So now you get two and for then, one, yeah.
And kind of like did that and had like over 400 domains where just by bartering, and then like somebody might want it because the holding cost of a domain is not very high.
Right.
So I'd wholesale, then decided to, you know, build proxies, so because I was in high school, I didn't speak English. I wanted to play games because I couldn't talk to people.
Okay.
So I would go to the library, and there were every game website was blocked. So I started, you know, Googling how do you bypass this thing, and there was a thing called proxy.
Right.
I went to all popular proxies; they were also all blocked. So I said, well, you know, they're basically blocking by domain, and I have tons of domains. So I just started putting proxies on my own domains so I could play games in
and
school.
And you could bypass them then.
Right. But then my domains started getting tons of traffic. So then after that, I would just kill the proxy and put it on Zito and parked it. And then,
that's awesome.
And so that was like the way, way back in the day.
That's great. That, I mean, that's innovative. Like, you know, you're like, okay, I don't care about anything else. I just want to go play some games in school, or I just wanted to go get some candy and all that.
Right.
And, you know, that kind of got you started in your entrepreneurship.
Absolutely.
So kind of through that process, maybe what's one thing that really made it unique that worked well for you, you know, as an entrepreneur? Like, what did you learn from that you still apply and use today?
You know, one thing I learned was that whatever is listed there isn't always the only way.
Okay.
You know, like, domain costs this much. Well, I didn't have that much money.
Right.
So how can I figure out a way to get around that?
Yeah.
And that really allowed me to be creative with the deals that I've done over the last, you know, over my career.
Sure.
Just because I'm like, okay, well, they don't have this. Let me ask, can they do this? I think that part, and the persistence part, has been really
the key
for me. Like, you know, like, I'm 27. I've been doing it since I was 12. So, so like, I guess now I'm like, I've made it, maybe.
Right. Maybe. Yeah, we'll see. That's super cool, man. Going to college, I mean, did you kind of start other entrepreneurial ventures along the way? Did you just kind of stick with one throughout that process?
No, so I was dabbling into things. So I was like, oh, well, if I develop websites on these domains that are way better than just like holding on to domains. So I started developing, you know, AdSense sites and content sites. And then turning those around, I was like, okay, well, I need SEO, obviously, for these. Started really learning that piece of it.
Nice.
Got really, really good at traffic part.
Okay.
You know, with MySpace, had tons of massive, massive MySpace accounts, like influencer accounts.
Nice.
It was like all fake profiles at that time.
Right.
but I had tons of traffic from there. You know, Dig, StumbleUpon.
Right.
Had power user profiles, so it could drive insane amount of traffic there. And, you know, from content sites to affiliates and you know, going from there, had to learn the development piece. So what I realized, what I was very, very good at the combining the dev and marketing.
Okay.
And the amount of traffic that we could bring, we started just working with enterprise.
Cool.
Enterprise okay. clients as a service business. And yeah, then fast forward, I was like, okay, well, I'm doing this for other companies. I got to, you know, turn around and do it for myself now. And then the software.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. I am Josh Felber. You are watching Making Bank. Get out and be extraordinary.
Thank you for listening to Making Bank. If you have enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And sharing is caring. Follow Josh Felber on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram for more. You can also listen to Making Bank on Amazon Alexa, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and watch on Apple TV, SuccessThinkers Network, Amazon Fire, and YouTube.